So this week, we read the story of Noah, a narrative that might also be titled, God Learns to Accept Reality. Of course, we think, well, didn't God create this reality? Why couldn't God have created a better reality without evil? And then God would not have to destroy God's own creation. Yet, as we often say, Torah is descriptive, not prescriptive. Torah reflects the world as it is. It's a mirror in which we can see ourselves. Rabbi Lou reminds us in This Is Real and You Are Completely Unprepared that the Torah never permits too much distance between the values it proposes and the way people actually behave.
I don't have to listen to this here, by the way, if it's bothering anyone.
No. Because Torah recognizes that to create too much difference between what it proposes and what people actually do would break that connection between our lives and the Torah. And evil impulses are, unfortunately, part of our world. And we, like the character of God in Parsha Noah, have to learn to accept that there's only so much control we have over the projects that we launch, the children we bear, and the world we build. In last week's Torah reading, Bereishit, God created heaven and earth with all its life forms, including humans. And in that first week, at the end of each day, God reflected on everything that had been created and saw that it was good. Vayar Elohim ki tov. Shortly after, Adam and Eve are expelled from the garden for breaking the one taboo, eating from the tree of knowledge of good and bad. And within one generation, Cain murders his brother Abel out of rageful envy that God favors Abel over Cain. Within 9 or 10 generations, God saw how great was the human's wickedness on earth and how every plan devised by the human mind was nothing but evil all the time. And God regretted making humans and decided, I will blot out from the earth the humans whom I created, together with beasts, creeping things, and birds of the sky, for I regret that I made them. But Noah found favor with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh saves Noah, his menagerie, his sons, and their wives. Though the flood covers the land for 40 days in one version of the story, Noah's family seems to spend a year in the ark before the land is dry enough to leave the ark in another version of this story that seems to be two different Noah stories put together. They finally emerge with all the other living creatures. Noah built an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings. The Lord smelled the pleasing odor and said, never again will I doom the earth because of humans, since the devising of the human mind are evil from youth, nor will I ever again destroy every living being as I have done. I don't see any explanation for this transformation of God's attitude toward humans, this move from intolerance to acceptance, from judgment to compassion. It could hardly be just from the pleasing odor of the sacrifice, which is the explanation implied by this part of the text. Yet God speaks of true acceptance. In the same breath that God promises never to destroy humanity again, God acknowledges that the human mind is evil from birth. God isn't saying, well, I'll give them another chance because they might do better. Instead, God is entirely clear that the human mind is evil from birth, and God promises to never destroy humans again. And then what is the purpose of the sign of the covenant, the rainbow that God places in the heavens. God says, when I bring clouds over the earth and the bow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and every living creature among all flesh, so that the waters shall never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. God seems to need a reminder, like a sticky note that's on every cloud that might pour forth a flood. Remember not to destroy your creation again. And indeed, God does much later offer Moses an entirely new people, and Moses pleads for acceptance and compassion. So what has caused this transformation in God, this new capacity for acceptance of humans with all of our flaws? Perhaps, as the story implies, God recognizes that humans can't help but have scheming minds, given how we've been created. Devising evil seems to be part of the package of being human. And God seems to realize that starting over would not really help. There is something about the human mind that can't help but fall into these unskillful ways. Jewish commentary has a tradition of embracing both Yetzer HaTov and Yetzer HaRa, our good and evil inclinations, as part of the life force that keeps us going. Rabbi Lu, and this is real and you are completely unprepared, retells a story from Talmud in Tractate Yoma. The children of Israel, it seems, once prayed to God that the impulse that tempted them into sexual misconduct be handed over to them as a captive. After they fasted for 3 days and nights, this tempter was in fact handed over to them. The prophet warned them that if they killed it, they would bring the world down with it. So they imprisoned it for 3 days instead. But there wasn't a fresh egg to be found in the entire land of Israel for those 3 days. Finally, the story goes, they just put out its eyes and let it loose again. The Talmud, Rabbi Lu comments, seems to be saying that this business of desire is the basis of our creativity and productivity. Jewish tradition seems to take a practical approach to the craving and grasping that seem to be part of human nature, creating laws to contain our impulses and limit the possible damage done, but also accepting that craving and grasping are part of being human, and this assertiveness is part of what keeps the life cycle going. Like last week, I'll turn to our companion creation story found in Buddhist scriptures that focuses on how the world comes into creation in each moment through the 12 steps of interdependent co-arising, as Thich Nhat Hanh describes them in his interpretation of this text, also known as 12 steps of dependent origination. These steps describe how the nature of perception, the perception of self and other, self and things as separate, leads to suffering in this cycle of birth, death, and rebirth. The first step, avidya, is ignorance, seeing things as separate rather than interconnected. And this perception leads to a sense of alienation. The second step is impulse, or motivation. Somehow, seeing ourselves as separate sets activity in motion, doing something to something else. Third is consciousness, awareness of things. As soon as we come conscious of ourselves as the perceiver, we think we are separate from the things we perceive. Consciousness gives rise to our world. This step reminds us of the pivotal moment in the Garden of Eden when, after taking a bite from the tree of knowledge of good and bad, Adam and Eve suddenly become self-conscious, conscious of their nakedness, conscious of their grasping and ashamed before God. To be conscious of self is to feel separate. Consciousness makes everything into a name. It gives things a name and separates things out from their connection to everything else. It separates the perceiver and the perceived. Perhaps this is God's difficulty too in Parsha Noah. God sees humankind as separate from God's self. God sees God's own creation as separate rather than seeing that all of creation is God. The fourth step is the creation of the individual with a separate existence. The fifth step is the formation of the six senses. I don't have enough background in Buddhist scripture to give a good description of everything, but I just want to go through the chain. Sixth is the way the senses come in contact with the world. Seventh is the subjective feelings. I like it, I don't like it, or I really don't have any feelings one way or the other. Here's where we get to the steps that kind of lead to the more accessible parts of this teaching. So in the seventh step, we like or don't like something, which leads to the eighth step, that we crave for what we like, and we have an aversion to what we don't like. And when something's neutral, we just don't pay attention to it at all. The ninth step is clinging to things that give us pleasure, the activity of clinging. So there's the feeling, I like it, then the craving, and then the clinging. And that leads to the 10th step, are becoming part of the cycle of birth, death, and rebirth into this life of suffering. 11th is birth, but as Norman Fisher says in his commentary on this, birth is, of course, the cause of death, because once you're born into a human body, it's inevitable that you will die. And 12th, of course, is death. This series of steps is usually understood to show how suffering, dukkha, is inevitable. It explains how we continue to be reborn into what the Buddhists call samsara, or the wheel of birth, life, death, rebirth. And yet this chain also points to the four noble truths, or the four ennobling truths, and the practices and teachings that can release us from the cycle of suffering. For each step in the chain is a gateway into awareness that can help us experience the beauty and preciousness of this human life. So just to connect this to the Four Noble Truths that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, the first noble truth is the diagnosis. You've got suffering. There's suffering in life. The second is the cause of suffering. Clinging to wanting things to be different from the way they are. For example, to wish that we didn't have to get old or have illness or die. Third, the prognosis, that there is a transformation of this suffering. And importantly, as we discussed, Thich Nhat Hanh translates this as a transformation of suffering, not a cessation of suffering. And fourth is the intervention, the treatment plan, which is the Eightfold Path, that leads to our awareness of our interconnection with all things. So Thich Nhat Hanh looks at these 12 steps and formulates each step in the chain as a gateway to awareness that can help us appreciate the beauty and preciousness of this human life. Our recognition of ignorance, for example, the first step, leads to clear seeing. Our awareness of craving and aversion help us to see that our suffering comes from our not wanting things to be the way they are. Our liberation comes from being able to stay attentive to things just as they are without that reflexive impulse to change everything to satisfy a fleeting desire. Our liberation from suffering comes from awareness of this ineffable beauty of being alive, this miracle. Release from the cycle of birth and death is not, poof, we're transported into nirvana, but an understanding of no birth, no death, that comes out of our ability to embrace the interconnected nature of all things. So, for example, experiencing our lives as a waveform that's part of the water that continues even after our particular wave may not have that same shape, rather than thinking of our lives as these separate waves that all are going to crash and die. Liberation comes from awareness in this life, not escape from this life. And that's Thich Nhat Hanh's message here. And that is why we keep coming back to meditate together, to support each other in creating that non-conceptual space in which we can touch the interconnected nature of our lives and sit with the impermanence. In the story of Noah, God is confronted with all the challenges that arise from humans having consciousness of their separateness, a consciousness they acquired by eating the apple in the Garden of Eden. And once that consciousness arises, of course, the chain of dependent origination leads humans to crave and grasp. God saw all the steps in that chain of dependent origination and regretted making this human consciousness and decided to wipe out living creatures and start all over again. Yet somehow in the process of saving Noah and his family, God has a change of heart. Still clear-eyed about humans' propensity for craving and grasping, God decides nevertheless to refrain from destroying mankind. We are not given an eightfold path in this part of Torah to chart our path to compassion and liberation from suffering, but we are given instructions through the example of God's behavior. God learns to accept humans just as they are, flawed and imperfect. God promises to remember God's everlasting covenant with all creatures, all flesh that is on earth, to never destroy life again. So what do we learn from God's example about responding to the evil plans of human beings? The rainbow, God's reminder of the covenant, is for us as well, a reminder that even in the midst of clouds and threatening skies, we can see the beauty and preciousness of life.